This week's episode is a bit different. Liberty's taking the week off, and maybe next week, so I'm doing the episode by myself. So we'll see how it goes. So please bear with me. This episode is going to talk about when multiple agencies do good investigating and hard work that all lead to a common goal: ending human trafficking. Hey guys, this is The Missing Ones, and I'm Alexis Peterson. So, like I said in the intro, Liberty's taking the week off. Just with everything going on, starting a new job and having mom duties, it can get a little hectic. So she's taking the week off and I'm hosting solo. It's kind of weird just talking to myself. So we'll see how this goes. Please bear with me. I've never really been a huge talker unless I know, like, I'm one of those people who are super quiet, but then if you can get me talking, I will not shut up. I'm starting a new experiment with my husband. We just bought HelloFresh, and if you've been on podcasts, I'm sure you've heard it from every single podcast about how good it is, how it saves you time and money. And so yeah, we decided to take a chance and to test it out. So far, we've only had one meal, and we got this like Dijon salmon meal, and it's pretty good, as long as you follow the instructions, which not everyone does. So for us, the salmon turned out really good, and the wedges turned out okay, but the zucchini that was supposed to go with it just was a total flop. It was kind of simple. They give you instructions on how to do it, and it had pictures, which for me personally helps because I could be like, I'm not quite sure what it is. So having a visual is definitely a bonus for me. And so I will keep you guys updated how we decide. So far we've only ordered for 1 week, but I think we've planned for a second week. If you guys want, I will keep you guys updated on if I really think it's worth it and if it really is worth the money and if it actually saves you money. Because it's nice that it allows, like, you can see the meal you want and it gives you just enough ingredients to have enough for the portion size. And so it cuts back on waste. And for us, we order, like, we got a portion size for 4 people, and that way there's enough for like dinner and then like 2 lunches. And so it's nice because then we have leftovers and it's really good and we only have to make it once and not have to think about it. But yeah. So trying to think if there's anything else. I'm just pretty boring person, honestly. I just do the same routine almost every single day except for on recording days, and that's when I usually chit chat with Liberty. And so yeah, we'll see how it goes. Okay, so we will get into this episode right after this ad break. So just a quick disclaimer before we get started. Today's episode talks about abductions and some other triggering things, so please proceed with caution. I do want to note that all of the victims in these cases are considered to be some of the most at risk and challenging recovery in those areas. Police base these risk factors on victimization of child sex trafficking, child exploitation, sexual abuse, physical abuse, and medical health conditions. I'm also going to note that there's nothing specifically stating in the research that I did about these different operations on how exactly they did it. So like most cases, you hear the police investigated so-and-so and they tracked the phone records and stuff like that. In these cases, it doesn't say. And here's why I think why that nothing has come out. I think that the tactics they're using are working, and so they didn't want to disclose it for the fear of it not working anymore. Does that make sense? Like, I think that what they're doing is working and they want to keep having it work. And so they don't want to say, well, we tracked based on this, to have who they're tracking catch on and then change tactics, and then they have to figure out new tactics. But I will mention an operation that we posted that has come out with their tactic, which was called Operation Broken Hearts. We posted this last month on our Instagram, so if you want to go check it out, you can go check out that snippet and the source we found it on. In this operation, which was located in, I think it was in Arizona, they arrested 37 people, and the way that they did it was the police used several sites known for human trafficking and caught both the traffickers and the buyers, and that's all that they mentioned. So that's all I'm gonna mention. Okay, so we're gonna talk about how operations are formed. From what I could tell, human trafficking falls under tactical operations. And these tactical operations specialize in missions involving homeland security, national emergencies, and the intelligence community. So it's a pretty wide net, as far as I can tell. They are usually made up of 80 to 100 volunteer deputy U.S. Marshals who then have to meet a higher standard and complete rigorous training in situations that they might encounter. And I'll play you guys a little audio clip on, this was found on the U.S. Marshals page, and we will link their news feed so you guys can keep up to date on what they're up to and other missions that are going on. It's going to be the first few minutes of the video, because the rest of the video, they muted it to keep identities disclosed. And since these are all dealing with minors, it's very important.
With them, or the possessions that would assist them in leaving, are going to be tucked away or hidden or in another room. We can look to the remoteness of the location or the configuration of the living situation. And it may be a scenario where an actual threat never needed to be made. It was just the presence of the weapon that the child knew they weren't free to leave.
Rescue some kids who really need to be rescued. You're going to give some kids who've made some bad choices because they've been dealt a bad hand of cards.
So, as you can hear in this clip, they talk about indicators of what to look for when entering a potential human trafficking environment, why they should care about the runaways, and they go over case files with multiple people so everybody understands it, which I think is really smart, so everybody is on the same page. And like I said, later in the video, they do show a rescue, but they do mute the audio just to keep everything disclosed. But you can go check out the video. We will link it in the show notes and on our blog. So if you'd like to go see more, that's where you can find it. Before researching, I've heard of the U.S. Marshal, but I've never really understood what they did. So the U.S. Marshal was started in 1789, and it basically serves as the enforcement arm of the federal courts. They are usually responsible for bringing about 100,000 fugitives to justice every year. Isn't that insane? In one article I found, it said that before February of 2020, the U.S. Marshal was used to find fugitives, but since then they've switched their focus more towards finding missing and endangered people. In another article, it said that since 2005, the Marshall's Office have helped find 1,800 missing kids. Their long list of duties include protecting the federal judiciary, apprehending federal fugitives, housing and transporting federal prisoners, managing and selling seized assets acquired by criminals through illegal activities, and operating witness protection. And boy, that was a mouthful. On top of all of that, they also coordinate efforts with other federal, state, and local law enforcement, which can be a good thing and a bad thing. On one hand, it could be good where there are a lot of people involved to get a task done, and then it becomes more efficient. But we all know those cases where different agencies fight over jurisdiction that can hinder an investigation. I'm sure all of us can think of at least one where this has happened. But today, we're gonna get into when all of these agencies coming together ended in success stories. So let's go back to mid-August, early September of 2020. The U.S. Marshals Office rescued 72 children across the Midwest in two separate operations. The first one was Indiana's Operation Homecoming. The next was Ohio's Operation Safety Net. And the third one was Georgia's Operation Not Forgotten. And I'm going to go into each of these since they all are linked together. At least they happen like simultaneously. And so you'll get to hear a little snippet. So let's start with Operation Homecoming in Indiana. This is not the same as Operation Homecoming from 1973. And I've had a couple people who I were talking to who kind of, when I just mention Operation Homecoming, that's the first thing that they think of, which is about bringing American prisoners home from the Vietnam War. And we can link, I think we have a website, so we can link that also if you guys like to support that and read more on that. This operation that happened in 2020, the Marshals Office coordinated with Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to lead to the recovery of 8 highly endangered missing children and 1 arrest. And the person that was arrested was charged with parental kidnapping, possession of weapons, and intimidation. I found that it was reported that the IMPD used every resource available at their disposal. While in the media, it's easy to assume that operations like this happen in an instant, like you think someone just reported missing and then bam, they're found, right? That's what I think. That's what you see on every crime show. Well, actually, it takes a little bit longer than that. In this case, it took several months of planning. The children were all reported missing by local law enforcement. They were also plugged into the National Crime Information Center, as well as the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Because of this, officers were able to use the children's case files that included the last known locations, friends' houses, and schools. After several months of planning, they executed this operation in 1 week. So, while it may not look like a lot at first, it did happen pretty quickly. I mean, getting it done within a week is pretty remarkable. Originally, they were trying to find 18 missing children, but they were only able to recover 8. And these children were between the ages of 6 to 17 years old. And after recovery, law enforcement made sure to get the kids to proper resources to start their recovery process. So that happened end of August, I believe. The next one that happened end of August and early September was called Operation Safety Net in Ohio. So in this case, the U.S. Marshals Office coordinated with the East Cleveland Police and Newburgh Heights Police to complete this mission. Officers were looking for children missing from the, sorry if I mispronounce this, Cahuilla County area. During this operation, 35 missing and endangered children were recovered. 25 of them were within the first 2 weeks, between the ages of 13 to 18 years old. That's pretty, like, wow. I mean, the fact that they were able to find 35 total and 25 within the first 2 weeks, I think that's pretty good, considering the last one, they were looking for 18, but only recovered 8. And it was also reported that 20% of the children recovered were tied to human trafficking. Can you guess what states these children were found in? And yes, I said states, as in plural. And here's a hint, they're not close together on the east side of the U.S. The children recovered throughout Ohio, which is expected, as well as Miami, Florida. And let me tell you, that's not just like a 2-hour drive or 5-hour drive. That's like several days. You know, I've almost basically made that trip. And it's not an easy one. So the fact that these children that were missing from Ohio were found all the way down in Miami, Florida is crazy. And I guess apparently there's a big problem in Southwest Florida with human trafficking. In an article, I can't remember which one, it was said that there are 3 types of slavery in that area: servitude in the fields, sex slavery, and indentured servitude in the homes. And the police are actively trying to put an end to this. As of February 2021, there was a huge bust in Tampa where 75 people were arrested. 75! That's crazy. But it goes to show you that it's not being put on the back burner. Police are actively, you know, seeking out justice. And just like in other operations, the kids that were rescued were given medical checkups, and some were returned to their families. I'm going to mention that in some cases, during the research part of the investigation, they found that some of the children's homes that the kids left were worse than the place that they were rescued from. So I think it's very good for the police to find this out before returning the kids, because that could make or break a kid's life. And so the fact that they did proper research and were able to get these kids to the correct resources and save them from not just a bad scenario, but an even worse scenario, I think is very important. For this operation, 40 missing cases were referred to the U.S. Marshals Task Force, but like I said, only 35 were recovered. So what happened to the other 5? Well, those still remain open, and they did release the names of these kids to hopefully have the public help. I'm gonna butcher these names so bad, so I am so sorry. But we will link this and post these kids on our Instagram and show notes and blog, so you can easily find it. The first one is Latwana Bates. She's 17 years old, 5'3", 135 pounds. She was reported missing April 18th, which is exactly a year ago from yesterday. So she was reported missing April 18th of 2020 from Youngstown, and she was believed to be near the east side of Cleveland. It looks like another girl. They must know each other because they're in the same photo. standing next to each other. So the next girl is Yolanda Bates. She's 15 years old, 5'3", and about 100 pounds. She was also reported missing April 18th of 2020 from Youngstown, and was also to be near the east side of Cleveland. So the next missing kid who's still missing is Janaea Scott Lee. She's about 16 years old, 5'3", and about 130 pounds. And she was reported missing August 23rd of 2020 from Cleveland, and she's believed to be in Ulysses. The next one is, I don't know if it's Alicia or Alicia. I've heard it both ways. I'm just going to say Alicia Jackson. She's about 16 years old, missing from Brea. She was believed to be near the east side of Cleveland and possibly the Glenville neighborhood. And the last one is Isaac Ortiz. He's about 16 years old, and he was reported missing from Lorraine. He was believed to be near the west side of Cleveland. So if you have any information, you can reach out to the U.S. Marshal's Office or any local law enforcement. You can reach the U.S. Marshals at 1-866-492-6833 if you have any information. You can also submit a tip to USMS Tips, and we can leave a link for that as well. So those are the five missing children that are still missing from that operation. So we encourage anyone listening, if you have any information, please leave a tip or tell us, or, you know, and we can submit it anonymously for you. And because of the success of the mission in Ohio, the U.S. Marshal for the Northern Unit of Ohio has created a permanent missing child unit throughout the 40 counties of Northern Ohio, which I think is a huge, like, achievement, because the fact that they're dedicating a force just to look for missing kids will help so many out there. So let's move on. The last operation that we're going to go over is Operation Not Forgotten, that was in Georgia. Again, I will mention that this is not a part of the Operation Not Forgotten. That's a nonprofit organization whose mission is to improve a veteran's quality of life in areas of mental, emotional, social, and spiritual health. We will link their website in the show notes and on our blog. So if you do want to support them, we will give you the link. Anyway, the Operation Not Forgotten that I want to talk about today led to the rescue of 26 children, leading to the safe location of an additional 13 children and 9 arrests in Georgia. I do want to note that as of April 9th of 2021, they conducted another Operation Not Forgotten in Maryland. Remember how I said that they didn't want to disclose tactics because they were working? This is kind of why. So they used the same Operation Not Forgotten in Maryland, and it was just completed after 60 days with a recovery of 18 children and a safe return of 11 more. And it also led to the location of 102 children that were reported missing and since have been returned to their legal guardians. Isn't that crazy? Like, that just blows my mind that there's that many. Like, you know, you'd think, I don't know. You know, I just don't ever put in perspective how many children there are actually missing. And to hear a number that big is just crazy. But it's so great to hear that all those children have been rescued and recovered. And like I said earlier, if you want to keep up to date with everything that the U.S. Marshal has been doing, we will link their, like, news feed that they update on, like, with the rest of our show notes and resources. And so you can go check it out there. This operation in Georgia took 2 weeks to complete. It had multiple agencies working together, including the U.S. Marshals Service Missing Child Unit, the agency's Southeast Regional Fugitive Task Force, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and Georgia state and local agencies. So that's even more agencies working together, which means more eyes. But then, like I said, sometimes it can get a little muddy. But in this case, it didn't. 15 of those victims that were recovered were believed to be a part of sex trafficking. The other victims were endangered runaways, children missing from care, and children abducted by family members. The ages for these kids who were rescued were between the ages of 3 to 17 years of age. During the rescue, children were actually surprised when the police showed up. One asked why the police were there, and when the police responded by saying, "We're here for you," can you guess what the kid's response was? The kid said, "I didn't know anyone cared enough." Isn't that heartbreaking? That, which is some of these cases. So I was listening to another podcast called Obsessed with Disappeared, and they are a kind of like a rewatch podcast. So they watch episodes from the ID Network. They have two series. They have True Crime Obsessed and Obsessed with Disappeared. And they watch the episodes and they comment and go through it with you. And in one episode, literally, if I remember correctly, they did find the person like years down the road, and they honestly, the person who was found, had no idea anyone even cared or was looking for her, which is so heartbreaking. But there's always someone who cares and someone who will look for you. So you would think the rescue of 26 initial children, and then an additional 13 children, and then leading to the recovery or the known location of 102 children, you would think that's a victory, right? Well, some people were criticizing the timing of the operation. In most cases we hear, there can be bad outcomes because the police didn't act soon enough or they butchered the job. In this case, after the announcement of the rescue, the police were facing backlash of not finding the kids sooner, which makes sense if you see it from an outside perspective. Like I said, most times you see on TV, there's a report missing, you think, and you see the research done, and it seems fairly easy, and it seems to go by within like a few days to a week. But in this case, you know, people are thinking it was a human trafficking ring. All these kids are in one location, right? Well, that actually wasn't the case. Initially, the police were looking for children that met a certain criteria that was mentioned earlier. So if you missed it, go back. The other part of why it took a little bit longer to find these kids is because they were located all over the U.S. So no, they weren't in a huge sex trafficking ring or human trafficking ring. They were found in multiple states and multiple jurisdictions. In this operation, the kids were found in Tennessee, South Carolina, Oklahoma, Florida, Kentucky, and Michigan, as well as Georgia, because that's what it was based out of. So you can't really say like, well, you didn't act soon enough or it took too long, when in actuality, they weren't looking for all of these kids. They were looking for certain kids that kept leading to other kids, and then it grew more and more. And they weren't in one location or even one state, which made it a lot more complicated. So before I want to go, I'm going to mention that in 2015, the Justice for Victims of Trafficking Act was established. And why am I talking about this act? Well, it kind of plays an important factor onto why these operations take place. This act allowed marshals the authority to conduct these investigations. It allowed them to provide law enforcement across the country with resources to either establish or enhance their task forces against human trafficking, fund prosecution, and create trafficking victim services, just like the one in Ohio that they were able to create a permanent force for. The main goal of this act is to provide restitution and justice for victims of human trafficking and child pornography by imposing fines and penalties against the offenders. So this act actually layers on top of a couple other acts that were created in 1968, 1990, 2000, and 2005. And because of that, like, each act already has its own fines, and then this increases the fines on top of that, if that makes sense. And so with this new act, it actually helped expand the definition of child abuse under the Victims of Child Abuse Act of 1990. So now it includes human trafficking and child pornography to also include criminal charges to the buyers, not just the sellers. Also, producers of child pornography films are now classified as human traffickers under the act. So that just shows you, like, they're constantly improving these acts to seek justice on everybody, not just one party who's abusing these kids. So with this act, it also allows programs to provide services for the victims of child pornography. So yeah, we're gonna end this one on a high note. Yeah, I'm just really happy that so many kids were able to be recovered and were able to get the help that they need. Not only just with recovery initially by the police, but having programs set in place to have a better recovery for afterwards. Because we've also heard in an earlier one of our episodes, and you can go back and listen to it, we've heard where the girl was rescued by family, but she didn't quite get the help she needed and kept going back to her abuser and eventually ending her life. So if you want to hear that, not that you want to hear that sadness, but hear her story and what to look for, go check out that episode. And that's why I think having these services are so important. I also want to say that, you know, just because we think it should be done very fast because these kids do need to get rescued, it doesn't happen so easily. It doesn't happen in an instant. It happens when police feel confident that they can make the arrest and they have enough information to do it correctly. That's why I thought it was good that they shared kind of the behind the scenes in the video from earlier, that, you know, they do take into consideration everything. You know, they are highly educated on different scenarios, so they are well prepared for what they're walking into. And even then, they're not always prepared, but it's at least a start. We'll get right into the highlighted kid for the week. This one's an old one, but that doesn't mean somebody doesn't know something. So this kid's name is William Ebenezer Jones Jr. He was born March 5th of 1959. Like I said, it's an old one. He was born in Bridgetown, New Jersey. He has blonde hair, blue eyes, was 3 feet 6 inches tall at the time of the disappearance. He weighed about 35 pounds at the time of his disappearance. He's male, he's white. He does have a vaccination scar shaped like a giraffe. That's kind of weird. Like a giraffe on his back left arm between his elbow and shoulder. They just have additional information was at the time of his disappearance, he loved dogs and would do anything for a dog. The details of his disappearance are on December 17th of 1962, the then 3-year-old Billy, who he was also known by, was last seen outside of his neighbor's house in Vineland, New Jersey around 11:45 a.m. He was last seen wearing a light blue or grayish snowsuit with a navy collar and silver buttons, a hat that matched his snowsuit, a tan high-top crepe-soled shoes with yellow laces, and he reportedly had a dime in his pocket that was given to him by his mother. On the website, the FBI.gov, it provided several photos of what he looked like. It showed, I don't know, what is this house? It must be the neighbor's house. And it also gives like a location of like where his house was. It also shows a progressed age photo that you can go check out. The last scene was at his neighbor's house in the early morning. So if you have any information, I know this is the old one, but maybe, I don't know, your family member knows or someone you know knows, you can contact the embassy. You can contact the Vineland Police Department at 856-696-1212, and the field office is Newark. I think that's it for this week. Thanks for bearing with me. Yeah, we'll see what next week brings.
Remember to follow us over on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Missing Ones Pod. You can also join us over on Facebook in our discussion group. Just search the Missing Ones discussion group and hit join. We want it to be a space for people to come and talk about the podcast, missing kids, other cases that draw their attention, or, you know, any suggestions that you guys have as well. And most importantly, share with your friends.
Have a great week.
Bye.